Welcome to Understory, WA's only environmental radio show. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. Today I'm talking with Griffin Longley from Nature Play about a crisis in mental ecology. You'll find out what that means later on. As well as with Tim Beatley from the University of Virginia about designing more nature-friendly cities. Before we hear from Griffin Longley himself, I want to start today's show with two quotes. The first comes from Joseph Wood Crutch. It goes like this. We've not merely escaped from something, but also into something. We have joined the greatest of all communities, which is not that of man alone, but of everything which shares with us the great adventure of being alive. And now for a slightly less highfalutin quote, and it comes from a fourth grader in San Diego. And he says, I like to play indoors because that's where all the electrical outlets are. So to the show, I began by asking Griffin, what is Nature Play?
Yeah, Nature Play WA is an organisation that began at the Department of Sport and Recreation, and we've actually gone on to become a not-for-profit association now. But what we're about is trying to get kids outside mucking around again in the way that kids always have up till now. But it's a strange thing that you have to have an organisation to try and promote that sort of thing, but that's the reality of modern life, unfortunately.
Okay, so it's an NGO and it's based in the Department of Sport and Recreation in Leaderville, I believe. When did it start, and did it start with a bang? What's the history of the thing?
Well, it's been a slow build up, really. I suppose it began last year in April. We had Richard Louv come over to speak. Now, Richard Louv's a journalist and a thinker from the US who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods: Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder, which is a thing he coined, really. It talks about the impacts of the disconnect that modern children have from nature and the way that flows through the rest of their lives. So he came over here to speak, and the Department of Sport and Recreation brought him across, and his speech was able to fill the concert hall without any advertising at all. So it was over 1,400 people rocked up by word of mouth.
I was one of them, in fact.
Were you? Right. Yeah. So you're familiar with his work?
I hadn't read his book at the time, but I have read most of it now. And Nature Deficit Disorder. How would you define Nature Deficit Disorder?
Look, the way I think about it really is the impacts of modern childhood. And the thing is that the world is changing around us in an enormous number of ways and at an incredible rate. But one of the biggest and most rapid changes is the way that childhood is experienced. And to me, Nature Deficit Disorder is all about that change and the impacts that that change has on kids. And the number one difference is that kids just aren't getting that outside time that they used to. And when you think about nature, it's easy to think about it as forests and waterfalls. But to me, nature is everything that's outside your door. It's the sky. It's even the pavement. I would go that far. And kids just are so locked up in their houses these days, it's verging on a form of house arrest. And the impact of that is Nature Deficit Disorder, which flows through in their mental health and their physical health.
So is that suggesting that kids aren't as mentally healthy, aren't as mentally robust as today, who are spending time on the computer, on Facebook, as kids were 20 years ago who were playing in the bush more? Is that the suggestion?
Well, it is, yeah. And there's a few things to back that up. I mean, for example, the most recent statistics from Western Australia show that 14% of West Australian children, primary school age children, have been diagnosed with a mental health disorder. So that's more than 1 in 10, and that's a dramatic rise on previous decades.
That's a lot, yeah. Would that include ADHD?
It does, yeah. Yep. So those sorts of problems are on the rise. The research linking that to the sorts of sedentary, indoor, isolated behaviours that kids typically spend a lot of their free time on these days. Now, there's a lot of research being done, but it hasn't been categorically shown. But I think, you know, the more you think about it, the more the link between those things becomes pretty clear.
So what's the problem? I mean, is the problem that Australian kiddies are fat? Is it obesity? Is it mental health?
Yeah, I reckon it's a range of those things. I mean, obesity is one that we hear a lot about, and rightly so. I mean, nearly a quarter of West Australian kids are overweight or obese, which is a dramatic increase in previous years. But it's not just, you know, nature play and the importance of having that unstructured time outdoors isn't just about your weight. It's about the imaginative space that you're allowed as a kid and the impact that has on the way you develop cognitively and emotionally. When I sometimes talk about the kind of digital play as not really being play, I think about it more as entertainment. I mean, it's sort of, to my way of thinking, that sort of play warrants the name of play in the same way that colouring in warrants the name of art. You know, it's really all the creative work's been done and the kids are left to fill in the gaps.
It's not quite a self-directed play.
It's not, and I don't think it leads to the kind of curiosity resilience, emotional resilience, that the kind of play that we end up arguing with a kid in the park about whose turn it is to bowl, those kinds of experiences are incredibly valuable.
But hang on, why can't we just encourage more team sports amongst children?
Yeah, good question. And one of the things that's often assumed in these sorts of discussions is that organised sport is on the decrease. You'll often talk to people and they say, oh, well, if kids played more sport. But the reality is organised sport participation in Western Australia has been going up for quite a while. In fact, we're at, I think it's 64% of kids are involved in organised sport. But the problem is the amount of time that you need to spend moving as a kid is so high that even if you play multiple organised sports, you're not going to get even the physical activity you need. For example, my kids, I've got a 12-year-old and 11-year-old, and they play basketball for two different teams. But even that doesn't add up to the minimum requirements of physical activity. It's all the hours between the structured stuff, after school, before training, before violin practice, before whatever it is you do, and after. Those are the hours when kids used to be jumping fences and riding bikes and meeting each other in the park, and that just isn't happening anymore. And you can see that if you drive around or walk around, preferably any Perth suburb, past parks, unless there's a cricket match on, you won't see any kids there.
But hang on, that doesn't really answer my question. What, couldn't we just have more team sports, like every night of the week?
Well, I suppose you could, but there are lessons that you learn from team sports which are important. But there's a lot you don't learn from team sports. Because it's such a structured activity, you don't get the chance to make up the rules. There's a referee there to arbitrate your disagreements, or you don't get the chance to invent, and you don't get the chance to work out your own problems with your peers. And, you know, in fact, Carlo Callaghan, our police commissioner, wrote a speech about this and delivered it, I think, a couple of years ago now, on the impacts of this sort of thing on an emotional intelligence, which I think is a very interesting thing for a police commissioner to be talking about.
Yeah, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. But he was talking about the fact that in this speech that he wrote, he was talking about the fact that with so much of children's communication happening digitally now through Facebook and texting and the rest of it, that the opportunities to be confronted with the emotional consequences of your actions are a lot fewer now. So you'll have bullying, for example, he was talking about in the past when, when he was a child, if someone was going to bully someone, they'd have to do it face-to-face. And there was always the chance there might be a physical response. Or even if there wasn't a physical response, you'd see the kid cry, or you'd see the emotional impact of having done that. And his view of it was that part of the reason we're seeing the problems we are in night spots is that a lot of people who are growing up now have been sheltered from the emotional consequences of their actions.
Okay. I'm talking with Griffin Longley from Nature Play WA. I remember reading a section of Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv where he's playing catch with his son on an oval in America, and a soccer team starts playing a match. So they're forced to move to the verge of the edge of the oval. And an Uber mum, a high-achieving mum with her child, rolls up that Richard happens to know, I think, from his high school. And she notices what they're doing, and she uses the phrase, "Oh, you're killing time, are you?" And Richard reflects on this as suggestive of how obsessed with achieving we've become, and productivity, and how just playing catch with his son has to be considered killing time. It can't be an end in itself. Is this part of the problem with the absorption in team sports, that it has to be productive, it has to be structured, and that is a symptom of our productivity-obsessed Australian culture?
I think absolutely. I think you're on the money there. I mean, you know, sport has very, very specified goals, and they're measured in really clear ways. You know, there's a scoreboard, there's a score sheet, there's possessions and tackles and goals and points, and there's not the room within that kind of structure to experiment. And even in terms of experimentation physically, you know, when you've got a kid playing football, for example, on a team with a coach and a series of parents watching them, if they try and do something that's too creative, too much flair in it, and it doesn't work, that kid's going to get pulled off the field and another kid's going to get put on. But the spaces, even within sport, where you get to experiment and learn lessons for yourself are when parents and adults aren't around. It's the kick to kick where the, you know, the real flair for sport comes in. But beyond sport, that ability to make creative use of the things that are around you, which is the fundamental trait of any leader in any field, isn't learnt in an environment where there are set rules, set structures, and arbitrators there and parents guiding every movement of the child. And it's that freedom to learn and to discover and to make mistakes and to hurt yourself. All those things are so important, and you know, a lot of that is missed in organised activities of many kinds, and sport is just one of them.
I mean, I think about the big flat oval, despite the fact of having to take part in a very structured process, a game with rules and an umpire. There's also the fact that it is flat grass. An oval is just flat grass. I remember when I was growing up, me and my friends would find our way into the wastewater drainage sumps where we would throw pig melons at each other, and these were the areas that were a bit more interesting. A bit of topography, the rises, the tree, climbing the trees. This much more three-dimensional than a flat green oval. It was much more interesting to us and lended itself more to play, I suppose.
It's interesting too that those are the things that you remember. All of us have had multiple hours spent in organised, structured things on flat grounds or in classrooms where the chairs were neatly ordered. But when we think about our childhoods, when we look back, the moments that we remember and the moments that we know had the impact on the way we thought about ourselves, about the world, they all, almost to a one, for almost everyone you'll speak to, happened in wilder places.
That was Griffin Longley from Nature Play WA. If you'd like to find out how Nature Play can help your own kids start playing in nature, then go to the website natureplay.org.au. If you don't have kids, you might even take the suggestions there for yourself. Next, I talk with Tim Beatley, an American academic from the University of Virginia, who was recently in WA talking about biophilic cities. What does biophilia mean?
Well, it's a term that Ed Wilson at Harvard has really popularized, and he means an affiliation with nature, this idea that we've co-evolved with the natural world, and we react, we respond to it. We actually need it. We need it in our daily lives. We're happier, we're healthier, we're more productive in work environments where we have nature close by. So that it's something that resonates, that connects with our, in a way, our ancient brain, that as a species we've been so close to nature, and only in the last little bit of our evolutionary period have we been in buildings and in cities.
Okay, so that's what biophilia is, in case anyone was wondering. We're sitting here on the Fremantle Esplanade, surrounded by nature in the form of lots of Norfolk pine trees. I'm here with Tim Beatley, and I'd like to ask you, Tim, have you seen any biophilic design in Fremantle, the place you've been staying, for the last couple of weeks?
Yes, been here about 3 weeks, yes. Well, for me, biophilic design, and I often talk about biophilic cities or biophilic urbanism, so It's the building, the built environment, the building, the home, the office, but it's also the spaces around the community, around the city. So
I guess a lot of people will think of biophilic design as architecture, buildings that imitate natural forms, but it's more than that,
right,
for you.
It's more than that. It certainly includes that, but I'd say one of the most biophilic things that you can do is to be outside, to be in places like this one, and to have trees and natural daylight and breezes and birds and life all around us. So in that sense, I would say there may not be in Fremantle a dramatic green wall or a building with a dramatic green rooftop or something that might be evidence of biophilic design, but it's all around us in this city. It's a very, from my perspective, a very green city, a very walkable city, a city and a climate where residents can be outside and can be close to nature.
I mean, could you say that's a bit of a contradiction in Perth in general, that we have so many gardens? The suburbs are premised on everybody having a garden, and that lack of residential density means we're not very sustainable as a city.
Well, I think that's right. What happens is that we spread out so much that it becomes difficult to do anything or function without driving. And so we're already spending 90% of our day typically inside. What's left is spent in a car, and we're not getting outside. So the compactness, actually, the density and the compactness help to create the conditions in which we can walk, and a walking life is possible.
Okay, and my big question for you, Tim, is this. Imagine you're tomorrow morning made Lord Mayor of the city of Fremantle. Let's not take Perth. Let's just start with something small like Fremantle. And you can do whatever you want, unlike the current Mayor of Fremantle. You have unlimited powers. How do you make Fremantle a biophilic city?
Yeah. Well, there's so many qualities that are already here in this city that already make this a biophilic place. That's where I would probably start, by acknowledging that, as I've just said, I think Fremantle is a terrifically walkable place. It's an outdoor oriented city, a city where you can live more of an outdoor life and maybe a little bit less dependent on the car. Spaces like the Esplanade, parks like this are tremendous. I'm looking over at the cafe with trees growing right through the rooftop. You know, it's a biophilic building. So building on that foundation, but there are lots of things that every city could do, looking for opportunities to expand the tree canopy, planting more trees, planting more native vegetation. Again, Fremantle's already got a lot of that. Where I've been living is in South Frio, and there are very few turf grass lawns. There are lots of lawns that have native vegetation and gum trees, and it is very green. But building on that would be terrific. The other part of a biophilic city for me, it's not just the physical spaces, it's actually the sensibility of the population. And encouraging people to be outside, creating the context in which they can enjoy nature, and that's partly educational. That's partly getting kids to start to pay attention and start to learn about the nature around them. It's birding clubs and bush conservation, bush restoration opportunities to be involved in restoring nature or conserving nature.
So you're saying you'd legislate that school kids in Fremantle had to have some kind of knowledge of the local plants and animals?
I'm not sure about legislating. I'll leave that to local residents and local officials, but it's a good idea.
Hey, come on, you're a megalomaniac in this example. You can do anything.
Well, that's true. I would, and we're talking a lot actually these days about ecological literacy and place-based knowledge, and one of the things that my research shows is that almost wherever you are in the world, lots of evidence about this, that people in modern society tend not to recognize native species of plants, animals, birds, trees. So there's a lot of work to be done, and we know the evidence that shows that learning can be improved, that actually place-based and nature-based learning in schools can actually help to to improve test scores and the pedagogy, very powerful pedagogy involved.
Okay, so how about this? There's a lot of 19th century balconies in Fremantle. Maybe some more plantings on them.
Sure, I think that's the biophilic agenda is look wherever you can and be creative and find places to insert nature. And it could be taking up pavement in many places, taking spaces away from cars, that's not always popular, and putting in sidewalk gardens. Balconies are terrific opportunities actually to grow food often, and we can do that. Rooftops, backyards, side yards, vacant lots, wherever we can in the city.
In your film, I think I remember the beginning of the film. What's the name of the film again?
The Nature of Cities.
The Nature of Cities, which I saw last week. And at the beginning of the film, there was a segment on the bats that roost under a particular bridge in a North American city. I can't remember the details.
Yes, Austin.
In Austin, Texas.
Yes.
And some of the reason they roost there is because there's places beneath the bridge the exact same size of holes they like to nest in. So could we even think about designing buildings in Fremantle that incorporated nesting sites for birds? Would that be an idea?
Sure, that would be an idea, and there are lots of examples actually of developments and cities that are encouraging that. Cities like Toronto that now have adopted bird-friendly design, urban design guidelines, and that have to do with minimizing certain glass treatments that reduce collision of birds, but also finding creative ways to encouraging nesting of birds. Absolutely. What are the equivalent? Don't know if you have bats around here.
Not many. No.
Not many. But I often ask the question of what is the equivalent of the Mexican free-tailed bats that exist in Austin. What's your local fauna that you could pay attention to and celebrate and foster connection to in the same way that Austin has?
And I think of the 28 parrot. I think that's a local bird that could do with a few more nesting boxes around Fremantle.
Terrific.
And there's also at the beginning of your film some great footage of the living walls in Paris. I was wondering if we could have any of those around here. Maybe the rainforest plants, I think, that are used in those plantings aren't appropriate to this Mediterranean climate we have here in Western Australia. But could we still have living wall here?
And you should. I'd love to see some of that happen here. These are Patrick Blanc's beautifully designed walls there. Patrick Blanc is a botanist, Parisian botanist, and he travels around the world and collects plants and then assembles them in these vertical gardens, these green walls. And the good news is that there are now lots of people doing different kinds of designs and using different materials, and some of them are small. There's a kind of technique for making kind of vertical green boards that can be hung on walls, and you could do a lot of that here, and using the vegetation that's native to this part of the world and that would do well in terms of the precipitation and temperatures and environmental conditions here.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking with Understory. That was Tim Beatley from the University of Virginia. Thanks for listening to Understory. My name's Tom Wilson, and you'll find links from the show at my blog, www.tmwilson.org/blog. See you next time.